Inoho, please be seated.
Thank you, Your Honour. I'm now going to move to the methodology included in Schedule 10A4. The first matter is one of noting that agreement appears to have been reached amongst the experts, which is good news indeed for this process. In terms of a matter, though, that did raise its head a week or so ago and certainly caused conniptions amongst some of us, was reference to the word average in the context of the hourly data set. Now, further explanation was given in relation to the use of that word in the context of the base data for rate of take calculations in Appendix 10 to the JWS. And as I read the explanation given, it wasn't a shift back to averages as we had been understanding averages in the schedule, but rather was simply describing the way in which the hourly data was actually being processed, but still reflective of maxima in terms of the rates taken. Now, the explanation is set out in paragraphs 49 through 53 of Appendix 10, but I'd be grateful if one of you, possibly Mr. Wilson, might just give a summary just to square away that the recommendation is not a shift back to averages in this context.
Simon Wilson. So that's correct. It's not a shift back to averages. It's reflecting the fact that effectively water meters capture volume over time and then work out a rate of take by averaging that volume across whatever the period of time is. Different water meters capture that over different intervals of time, and that creates problems when you're trying to define typical data. So the recommendation is to start using the average hourly data set. That is the data set that is used as standard by the council. So we create it on, I'm going to say, all our data sets, and if we don't, then we would create it on anything that was missing. It's the data set we use to assess compliance against rate of take limits. It's the data set we've done all our analysis for this process. It's just defining a standard-based starting point.
Are there any other additional observations any of the other technical witnesses wish to share in relation to that particular point? Shaking of heads. Now, the final matters that I wish to cover were just matters of consistency in terms of the drafting of the schedule itself, and I wanted to understand whether what appear to be some drafting inconsistencies are intentional in terms of specifically referring to different matters, or whether they are unintentional differences that might helpfully be corrected or standardised in terms of the language used. And the first example I could perhaps take you to is on page 12, and we're looking at the methodology under 10A4.2. And you'll see at the very top of page 12 that the methodology commences with the phrase, "where a consent being replaced." In contrast, if you turn over to what is page 15, albeit an unnumbered page, for methodology 10A4.4, under the methodology you will see reference to the phrase "where a consent or permit." And my question is, in relation to the methodology, should a consistent phrase be used across the different methodologies as referring to both a consent or a permit, or in the context of the annual volumes, have you added permits to mean or to capture something different?
Simon Wilson, no, there should be consistent use of wording. I'm not sure quite when that drafting error snuck in, but the consistency would be helpful there.
Now, I haven't managed to locate where you're talking about, so I've got the schedule in front of me, 10A.4, and the first reference was to what? Mr. Moore, if you could take me back to your first...
So you're on page 12?
Page 10. Oh, I've no idea, actually. I'm just looking at your document dated 21st of May, which is the JWS, including the annotations for sensitivity testing. My first, in particular 10A.4, the schedule methodology for calculating assessed actual usage for surface water and connected groundwater takes.
Yes. So
take me from there.
So if you turn over two pages, and at the top of that page should be number one, where a consent being replaced.
Okay. And what was your second?
If you turn over three pages to page 15, which is an unnumbered page, you'll see there a heading towards the top of the page, methodology.
Yep.
Underneath one, reference to where a consent or permit.
Okay, and the answer was you should use standardised language?
Some reason. Yes, that's correct.
Any preference whether it's a permit or a consent?
Sorry, Your Honour, can you repeat that?
Should it be, the reference should be to, should it be to a consent or to a permit? It may make a difference, it may not.
My instinct would be that it should say consent or permit, but I would leave that to the planners.
Okay. Do the planners have a view?
I agree with Mr. Wilson. I think it's best to state both consent or permit. Tom de Postmarker.
No contrary views? No. Now, the second clarification is on page 10 of that document, and it's subparagraph 4 of the methodology. And the second line there refers to a general pattern of taking, it shall be rounded down. Now, the phrase rounded down seems to have been, a different word seems to have been used elsewhere in terms of adjusted. And my question is, should rounded down, or is rounded down the correct phrase to use, or is the word adjusted more accurate in this context?
Simon Wilson, I don't have a strong view on whether it should be adjusted down or rounded down, but it should be consistent. So that was one we missed.
The final question relates to method 10A4.1, and on page 11 there has been a change recommended with respect to the exclusion for steps 4A to G, and the word only is recommended to be inserted and the word primary to be deleted. Now, as I read the joint witness statement, that recommended change was to provide greater clarity in terms of the carve-out for hydroelectricity generation. But is there somebody who perhaps might speak to the reasons or elaborate on the reasons for that change? Ms. Stiles, you've had the finger pointed in your direction.
Stephanie Stiles, I suspected it would point my way. This was simply to be explicit that there should not be any doubt that what we were meaning was consent applications that were relating only to hydroelectricity, and that if there was any ambiguity in the use of the word primary, then changing that to the word only would resolve that confusion.
Very clear, thank you. Now, those are my questions, so if you could please remain for any questions from my friends and then questions from the court.
Thank you very much. Ms. Dixon.
Thank you, Your Honour. I've really only got one question, and I want to go back to something you were discussing really early on this morning, which is the objective. And the two versions of the objective that are being proffered, and your reasons, differing reasons for preferring one over the other. And my question really is around version B and the addition of the words that you were discussing this morning, while not compromising the ability of the new land and water plan to give effect to the NPS FM 2020. I think there was general agreement this morning that there has to be a measure of uncertainty about that, given that we're dealing with a land and water plan which is yet to be notified and is presumably still being written, and we have an NPSFM that's in its infancy in terms of its application. And my interest is in how the non-complying rule will relate to that objective. And you said this morning that when a decision is being made on the non-complying rule, on an application under the non-complying rule, the consent officers within council obviously will circle back and the objective becomes relevant under the Act. I'm assuming that everybody's with me in I won't disagree with any of that position so far. So, isn't what's going to happen is that anybody who's applying under a non-complying activity rule is applying under that rule, obviously, because they don't fit the other two rules. And one of those reasons why they won't fit is that they want to apply for a consent term that is longer than 6 years. That automatically takes you out of the controlled activity rule. So you're applying for a consent term that is longer than 6 years because that's not appropriate or you don't fit or whatever. The decision makers within council are going to go back to the objective and they're going to be considering your activity and the longer consent term that's being sought against a very uncertain world. Not compromise the ability of the new land and water plan to give effect to the NPSFM. Isn't a decision maker going to look at that and say, well, we just can't know what might compromise, what might not compromise, and that's automatically going to drive a short or shorter consent term, maybe longer than 6 years, but it's not going to be whatever the applicant is seeking. Any comments on that?
Tom de Pulsmaker, I think you, from my perspective, you articulated the intent exactly what I had in mind. I think you're right. It points at a very uncertain world into the future, but that is exactly a clear signal that we shouldn't be granting any long-term consents. So version B, in my mind, drives you back towards a short-term consent, maybe a bit longer than 6 years, but the fact that the outcomes and the time frames that will be set in the Land and Water Plan to achieve the outcomes, the fact that they're not known is something that needs to be taken into account when making decisions on non-complying activities and the duration for the consents that will be granted under them.
If I can give an example of the way I think that it would potentially be considered, we know that there are a number of catchments that are over-allocated at the moment. The MPS has a very clear policy about reversing over-allocation. If somebody has is applying for replacement of a consent which basically maintains that over-allocation, then that is something that just by looking at the MPS you can, and because a new land and water plan has to give effect to the MPS, a new land and water plan will have to address that question of over-allocation. You can look at that and say, well, actually, if we grant a long-term consent on the, how is the term of the consent of this application going to affect the ability of a new plan to address over-allocation? And if the consent term stretches beyond the term of a new land and water plan, then it clearly will compromise that ability. If it's a shorter term, then it may not compromise that ability. So that would be, that's just an example of one of the potential types of consideration, and that relates to what I said before, is I think that it is that this objective enables us to assess those non-complying activities directly against the outcomes of the MPS and say, well, is the term of the consent or the characteristics of this consent going to mean that we cannot address those MPS outcomes through the land and water plan?
Except that the MPS FM is going to be relevant anyway, isn't it? This is actually a step removed further away from that in terms of uncertainty. It's the land and water plan's ability to give effect and a plan that we don't know anything about as yet.
Sandra McIntyre, I agree that there is some uncertainty there. Version A of the objective, I consider has greater uncertainty because what it says is to provide for a transition toward the long-term sustainable management of fresh water. What the intent is in terms of objective B, of the version B of the objective, is actually to provide greater clarity as to what are the outcomes we're looking at in terms of long-term sustainable management, that has to be considered in terms of the MPSFM, because we all know how many arguments there are over what sustainable management means. So in my view, version B provides greater clarity in terms of that.
Leaving aside the question of over-allocation though, that may be a situation where in an application it may be clear on the face of the application that you're dealing with a situation of over-allocation. There are plenty of other circumstances where that might not be the case. The court is still grappling with three quite significant issues that don't, two of which don't necessarily even relate to the taking of water. And I'm thinking about community water infrastructure that the court was hearing about yesterday morning, is the ongoing issue of the deemed permits in relation to particular hydro generation. There's another issue that seems to be floating around in relation to dam infrastructure itself and the whole question of maintaining, you know, the concrete, etc. Those are all big, expensive things with long lives. Ms Muir yesterday morning, for example, was talking about the fact that you might be trying to reconsent a project where you're actually still building the infrastructure that was permitted or consented under the previous consent during that time. It's those sorts of things that I suppose I would be most concerned about in terms of driving a shorter consent term, because, putting the idea to you really, that doesn't seem to fit with the first part of either version's framing of the objective, which is to provide for an efficient transition. There's just nothing efficient about having to reconsent community water infrastructure when you're in the process of building it.
Well, for reasons that for reasons I gave when examined on that matter last week or the week before, I don't have a problem with the efficiency of those longer-term projects and investment being granted controlled activity consent and then having to reapply or then go down through the land and water plan process within the next 10 years. That was the position that I've had in evidence and discussed last week.
Anybody else have any comments on, in fact, taking that kind of activity out of the non-compliant law, effectively putting it into the controlled activity?
Sorry, Ms. Dixon, I missed that. Could you put that question again?
I wondered if the rest of the panel had any comment on what I take Mr. Farrell to be suggesting, which is that for that kind of community infrastructure, it should not, in fact, be in the non-compliant rule, but could be accommodated within the controlled activity rule in some way.
Okay, and so here the proposition relates to the territorial authorities' community water supply, dams providing water for irrigation and the generation, and also infrastructure relating to, or infrastructural assets.
I'm not sure that Mr. Farrell went quite as wide as that.
To be clear, I was talking about the controlled activity pathway within the six-year time frame, as is already drafted.
So it would provide a simple pathway, but not a longer period.
Mr. Farrell, correct.
Yeah. For all of those activities listed, we're just trying to know what activities did you have in mind?
Ben Farrell, specifically the hydro and the drinking water supplies, and referring back to my early evidence, the RPS directives around regionally significant infrastructure.
So not dams for irrigation, where the primary or sole purpose is irrigation?
I have not covered the evidence on that.
Are there comments from others on the panel about either what Mr. Farrell has suggested or about how the framework of this plan could accommodate a longer consent term for the sort of infrastructure that we're discussing, rather than water irrigation, per se? I'm aware that I've been waved at from the screen. Yes.
Stephanie Stiles, this is a matter that I discussed specifically in my evidence and my summary last week to the court. And the proposition from the hydroelectricity perspective was to place an additional discretionary activity role for hydroelectricity generation for a longer than six-year duration, recognising those significant national and regional benefits and the scale and cost of the kind of infrastructure involved.
Yes. Do you have a kind of plan B for that approach? I mean, if the court chose not to go down that track, how would you see the non-complying rule objective conundrum that we've just been discussing playing out.
Stephanie Stiles, I see that conundrum remaining very problematic, not just with the wording of the objective, but also compounded by the wording of the policies with the avoid granting perspective. And I think it would be extremely difficult for any consent processing officer to determine what may be a useful duration under a objective that simply says you need to anticipate how a new land and water plan might give effect to the NPS in a way that is unknown for things like hydroelectricity infrastructure or community water supplies or the like, when it's not a question of whether the land and water plan will give effect, it's more about how it will give effect and how it will treat different activities and the ability to know whether that management approach will be compromised or not by an activity specifically in the interim.
Thank you. Mr. Moore?
Your Honour, I do wonder whether we're straying beyond the scope of this conferencing session, which had expressly excluded conferencing on provisions relating to community water supply and hydroelectricity generation. Now, I note the objective is, of course, relevant to those activities, but it does seem to be straying beyond the content of or the subject matter these witnesses were invited to be considering.
Just pause there, Stephen. What we would regard as big picture stuff, which is going to continue this afternoon when you move onto the dams anyway. I understand the issue with staying off the non-complying activity rule, because we said stay off it because there are some big calls to be made under that. Nevertheless, it particularly in the context of the objective and policies, it would assist us to have that teased out in relation to those territorial authority assets and dam assets, whether it's hydro or electricity, or which haven't, perhaps with the exception for Trustpower, the other two haven't even completed their cases. And so,
yes, there's also
we're intrigued to see where this is going. I mean, it's not issues that we're alive to.
If one looks at the personnel on the panel missing, for example,
missing.
Mr. Tews and Mr. Curran, who may be interested in those two topics.
Definitely, and they're not here.
I wasn't going to take it any further anyway. It was simply to help the court to see that the words and the objective, which look benign, may have implications when that objective is applied out across the rest of the plan framework in a context that I think is relevant, because it's an example of how the objective would be applied. But
in terms of the benignness or otherwise in relation to, just say, hydro, we've got questions about this objective and whether it is actually working on the problem that needs to be working on. So, that's certainly, we'll have questions about that. But can you just summarise for me, for example, in relation to hydroelectricity, your thoughts around why the objective may be working contrary to the outcomes for hydro in relation to either version proposed? Is it an absence of something as opposed to the presence of the words there?
I don't think the issue arises in relation to version A.
Mm-hmm.
In my submission, the issue that I'm concerned about arises in relation to version B, because in effect, the words that have been added to version B that the panel was discussing this morning, while not compromising the ability of the new land and water plan, etc. Not compromising requires a judgment call on council officers, decision makers' part.
Yes, and I take your point about that. Yeah.
So it's the...
Is there anything else apart from the not compromising that you're addressing?
It's the combination of the not compromising and the uncertainty of the unknown.
The unknown plan. Not compromising the unknown plan.
So that because a decision maker is going to look at that and consider, do I give 20 years, 12 years, 8 years, etc., the driver with those words is always going to be for a shorter duration. In the context of a non-complying activity, which a lot of activities are going to need to be if they want longer than 6 years. Now, I'm not saying that means 35 years.
No, obviously.
There's obviously a point, but there may be some activities for which more than 6 years is appropriate, and it's going to be hard to make, my submission, it's going to be harder to make a decision, an objective decision on an appropriate time frame. Because the objective drives you to a shorter period.
Because the objective drives you to a short period?
A shorter period.
Yeah.
Because of those words, not compromise. There's always going to be the difficulty of making a call on what might or might not compromise.
Particularly
in a situation where you don't know what the document is going to look like.
Okay. All right. And so that was the point of the questioning around hydro irrigation dams and the TAs, community water. Okay.
Because those are the sorts of projects...
That might go longer.
...that might need longer than 6 years to be efficient, using the earlier part of the objective.
Okay. All right. Understood. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honour. Thank you, members of the panel.
Ms. Williams.
I too am going to appeal for objective 10A1.1. And I think I wanted to come back to you, Mr. Farrell, and you had suggested the deletion of the "and timely" wording in, I think, both versions. And your preference, of course, is for version B. You also said in relation to version B, as I recall your evidence this morning, that without having the qualifying phrase at the end of version B, there was an overemphasis on efficiency. And that was what I took from your evidence, or it slanted towards efficiency, the objective slanted towards efficiency. And I would like to explore with you a little bit further around that and again what it is that is the difficulty there. But if we don't have that clause, why that would then mean that the objective is slanted towards efficiency and not perhaps sustainable management.
Mr. Farrell, where I came from was simply that version A does not have a directive relating to any outcome other than efficiency, effectively. So if someone applies for a duration longer than 6 years, then there is no bottom line as to what the outcome is intended to be, other than an efficient outcome.
Mr. De Pelsenmaker, you're looking like you might have some thoughts as well.
In my view, the efficiency relates to the transition to a land and water plan. Yeah. That's
okay. So the wording efficient and timely transition. Efficient has lots of meanings, and in some circumstances it could include, I guess, a component of time. But the timely, to me, my interpretation of timely is that that does add an impetus, that the intention is that the transition should happen sooner rather than later, which efficient on its own doesn't do.
Tom De Pelsenmaker. Yeah, efficiency is often seen in terms of the process. Mm. And the time, yeah, they're distinct. Thank you.
So do you agree that including and timely drives you towards a more limited, that the transition is intended to be a more limited process, a shorter process?
Correct. The timely relates to the time frames within which the outcomes need to be achieved, acknowledging that they're not known at this point.
Yes. So then we have the two versions, version A. And version A talks about to provide for an efficient and timely transition toward the long-term sustainable management of freshwater for Otago under a new plan. Version B deletes the toward the long-term sustainable management of freshwater and instead has the addition, the qualifying clause, which Ms. Dixon has just been discussing at the end of the objective. So it's to provide for an efficient and timely transition to a new plan by establishing an interim framework and including by enabling existing activities to maintain for an interim period. And then there's the addition, while not compromising the ability of the new land and water plan to give effect to the NPSFM. So that's the shift that has occurred between the two objectives, two versions of the objective, version A, version B. Version B, by shifting that emphasis on the new process to the end, what effect does that have?
Tom De Pelsenmaker, the idea of long-term sustainable management, that is actually captured, in my view, in version B, mm-hmm. in the reference to the new land and water plan, because that's what the new land and water plan needs to do. Sorry, could you repeat the question?
So what is the effect of moving...
Yes.
I guess the phrasing from the sort of the start of the objective to the bottom of the objective. Mm.
So I think the reason for supporting version B is because under version A, I think the long-term sustainable management could become a goal, mm-hmm. a driver towards which it becomes a target for applicants. By removing it and by simply referring to the or including the last sentence at the end of version B, I think it brings it back to the transition bit. Otherwise, I think there's a risk that we are going again, going to have to consider environmental improvement, things like that,
yes.
which this framework does not provide guidance on.
Right. So in part the intention of moving the phrase, however it is phrased, if I put it that way, from within the first paragraph to the bottom paragraph is actually to again bring this back to the intention to have the efficient, timely, process-driven plan change.
Tom Napoles, Margaret, that's correct.
Right. So then I'm now going to again explore with you all the phrasing of that final sentence. And as Ms. Dixon has pointed out, and also others this morning, there is this issue with lack of certainty and lack of knowledge and how to have account for and... Yeah, and this, of course, is where, as you say, this is relevant for non-complying activities where the duration sought is intended to be longer than the six-year transitional framework. And so there is a need to somehow have regard to something, but I'm just not quite sure that we've nailed what the something is. And do you have any comments? Anybody?
So the question, what is the something?
We want to state an outcome which non-complying, because this really is directed at non-complying activities. So we want to state an outcome which non-complying activities should be considering.
Yeah.
So how can we state that? What are we actually driving at here? And the problem is that the while not compromising wording requires a judgment call which on documents which don't exist, so that is problematic. So it's how to state that.
So your understanding of the while not compromising is the outcome for non-complying activities with a longer duration?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Sandra McIntyre?
Yep.
I understand the concern about referring to a document that isn't in at the moment. We've talked about through this whole process about how this is not your sort of run-of-the-mill plan change, and it is therefore a particular purpose, and that purpose is specifically to ensure that the land and water plan can do its job. And I agree, it's difficult to come up with wording to ensure that non-complying activities are assessed against the ability to do that without actually referring specifically to that is what we're wanting to do.
Yeah.
And so that essentially is why I've sort of come to the view that really it's better to actually be up front and say this is what it's trying to do rather than to try and frame that in some other way that is maybe actually less clear that is the purpose.
And Ms. Dicey, you've got a comment?
Sally Dicey. Part of the issue potentially is that we weren't specifically asked to think about the objective in terms of, you know, broader issues with it. It was restricted to considering whether specific purposes mentioned in Mr. De Palsmaker's evidence should be brought into the objective. And so we didn't actually turn our mind specifically to the non-complying activity policy framework gap. And I think part of the issue there is the original plan change was notified with greater detail contained in the policy itself that relates to the non-complying activity, and when it was amended, a lot of that detail and direction was taken out, or all of it was really taken out, and so now it really does, the rule sits there without any kind of parent or family in a way. So it is an issue, but it's not one that we specifically turned our minds to within expert conferencing. Beyond the fact that we all agreed that the other purposes discussed in Mr. De Pelsmaker's, or outlined in Mr. De Pelsmaker's evidence, were covered through the policies or other wording, and that included the use of the words existing activities and the objective in terms of representing historical allocation rather than granting, say, more allocation than it actually probably, or, you know, represents historic use.
Ms. Stiles, I just want to check in with you. I did see you nodding along to some of that, so do you have any comments?
Tiffany Stiles, I was nodding in agreement with Ms. Dicey's summary of our considerations.
Okay, thank you for that. Mr. De Pelsmaker, when you were, I guess, giving your reasons for why you support version B, part of the reasons, as I understood you to say it, was because of the need to take a precautionary approach in terms of those longer-term consents sought through a non-complying activity. And thinking about this in terms of that precautionary approach, do you have any additional thoughts about how we can achieve what you're trying to achieve whilst not perhaps requiring that judgment call about the non-existent document?
Tom De Pelsmaker, not at this point. I think the objective is to inform the whole plan change.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be taken into account when you're considering non-complying activities, but crafting it in a way that they provide for non-complying activities, I think that's a danger as well. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look down to the policy level as well, it comes back to short-term consents. One last point that I wanted to make is there is an uncertainty in either version. And sometimes the uncertainty is around words such as for the interim period as well. How long is that interim period? One thing I thought was that adding that last sentence helps to constrain the interim period.
Because it's clarifying that this is directed towards the new plan process.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And Mr. Farrell, you look like you have comments.
Yes, Ben Farrell. From what I've heard, I'm not overly concerned with the term not compromising on the basis that it'll be applied for the non-compliant activity regime. It's going to be a judgment call and it's going to be based on a case-by-case basis in terms of the evidence put forward at that time. To improve the wording, though, at least to respond to some of the discussion today and thus looking forward thus something, I'd make a few points. One is that you could delete reference to the new water and land plan and simply refer to instead Otago's regional plan framework. I think a key point to recognise that as well recognises that the operative plan, the current water plan, does not give effect to the NPS, fresh water. And so a application for a long-term duration would engage with both the operative and in the future planning framework.
Sorry, say that again.
Any application for a longer term duration than 6 years would engage with the operative plan framework as well as any future planning framework under the NPS. Even if it's not proposed, the provisions in the NPS, for example, the framework of Te Manawatā Wai and Ki Tika Tai would need to be applied on that case.
Mm-hmm.
which is sort of in another way of saying we're an alternative to referring to the plan framework, is actually to remove reference to the MPS and just jump in straight to implementing Te Mana Te Wai, for example. And just cut out the reference to a document which doesn't exist yet and focus on fundamental concept.
So just to encapsulate that, Mr. Farrell, as I've understood what you've just been telling us, you're proposing two options. The first is to say that rather than referring to the ability of the new land and water plan, instead to refer to, while not compromising Otago's regional planning framework, and giving effect to the NPSFM 2020 or something of that nature. That's the first proposition you've put forward?
Ben Farrell, yes.
And then the second option is actually to do away with references to plans and the NPS and actually go directly instead to Te Mana o Te Wai, so that it would become something like, while not compromising Te Mana o Te Wai, maybe something as simple as that.
Something as simple as that, being the fundamental concept of the MPS. And I say that on the basis that any short-term activity within this framework would not need to meet that test on the evidence we've heard. That's not the intent.
Okay. So we've got Mr. Farrell's two propositions. Perhaps if I start with you, Ms. Stiles, and I'm asking you to think on the hoof like all of us. So do you have any comments on either of those?
Bethany Stiles, I think it just further complicates the options that we've got in front of us, and I'm not sure that that necessarily helps the consideration to have four options instead of just...
All right. Ms. Dicey?
I agree with Ms. Stiles on that. I'd also say it would still make me a little bit nervous about applying under the RDA rule and then potentially having Te Mana o Te Wai as part of a consideration in terms of meeting the objective. Yep. And also there's agreement in Otago that we haven't yet given effect and understand what Te Mana o Te Wai means in an Otago context, so that's another complicating factor.
So you would rule out that last option?
Yep.
Okay. Yep. Who wants to go next?
Still thinking a little bit, but Sandra McIntyre. I would prefer there to be reference to the planning framework, and in part that's because giving effect to the MPSFM requires, it has all the process requirements in terms of it of having the engagement over what the values and outcomes are to be achieved, which is a key concern for Karunanga in terms of their involvement in that. And that is also part of their concern in terms of the situation we're in with the current regional water plan, and that is that there is very limited ability to look at cultural values in particular in terms of that. While that, I think, is incorporated in reference to giving effect to Te Mana o Te Wai, I think it's clearer if there's a reference to the planning framework for giving effect to that.
Thank you. And Mr. De Pelsenaker.
I agree with what my colleagues have said with respect to Te Mana o Te Wai. I think I agree that that is an underpinning concept that we need to move towards. But given that it has not been defined, I don't think that it resolves or the issue around uncertainty as to what the outcome is. I do think that with the reference to NPSFM that incorporates Te Mana o Te Wai. Te Mana o Te Wai, in my view, is pointing towards an outcome. The NPSFM, as Ms. McIntyre said, brings in process-related matters as well as the time frames within which you need to achieve them. I am pondering over the replacing the reference to the land and water plan with the Otago regional planning framework. I like to reserve my position, but I think when considering applications under non-complying rule, you still have to look at the RPS. It might be useful that RPS and the outcomes that it seeks to achieve, they will become known earlier. Mm-hmm. And the what is going to be stated in the land and water plan should not be at odds with what's in the RPS. So it might actually help at some point in time to provide more guidance for applications.
Thank you. Those are my questions, Your Honour.
Thank you. Mr. Welsh.
Thank you, Your Honour. I don't have much because many of my questions are already covered, but I just wonder if the other planners wish to comment on Mr. Palsmaker's last set of comments around moving towards the, and picking up Mr. Farrell's suggestion of including reference to the Otago Regional Planning Framework. Ms. Dicey or Ms. Stiles or Ms. McIntyre, do you have any comments on that?
Sally Dicey, I think it just circles back to earlier answers that I've given, that once you're in the non-complying activity space, then those things are relevant regardless. So I don't think we need to add them into the objective.
Stiles?
I agree with that exactly. Those are provisions that you have to consider anyway in a non-complying pathway.
And my second question essentially is just a point of confirmation or clarification for the planners that when you were considering both version A and version B of the objective, that was within the constraints of not turning your mind specifically to any bespoke provisions for community water supplies or hydroelectricity, wasn't it?
Stephanie Stiles, correct. We were directed in that conferencing not to consider wider matters.
All right, thank you. That's all, Mum. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Page?
My first question is directed to Mr. DePelsmaker. You favour version B and Ms. King favours version A. Does the council have a position about which version the council is promoting, or has it not decided that yet?
For me, it's a professional opinion, and yes. I assume it's the same for Ms. King.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay. The both versions begin with new words referring to a timely transition. Given that a regional plan must give effect to a regional policy statement, do you intend that the words timely transition be informed by the contents of the RPS, which has to set out timeframes for achieving long-term visions for fresh water?
Sandra McIntyre, I wouldn't make that direct reference, and in part that's because my understanding of the intent in setting timeframes for freshwater visions in the regional policy statement is that is intended to set out timeframes for action to achieve outcomes that may extend beyond the term of the land and water plan, so it provides that longer term vision. My view in terms of this plan change is that it's looking to achieve outcomes well before those longer term timeframes, because those are the end goal, but actually we need to be putting actions in place much sooner than that in order to be able to achieve outcomes by those long-term timeframes.
So how do we understand what the word timely means if it isn't a reference to timeframes that will be in the RPS?
To me, there's a direct link between the word timely and further and the land and water plan. So it drives you towards the time frames that are in the land and water plan.
So time frames
for achieving the outcomes.
Time frames for achieving outcomes in
the land and water plan. Because, if I may, the RPS will provide clarity around the time frames for achieving higher objectives or the freshwater visions. The time frames that are attached to limits, which is ultimately where the rubber is going to hit the road, yes, those will be set in the land and water plan.
Is it not safe to assume that the land and water plan will give effect to the RPS itself in relation to those timeframes?
Sandra McIntyre, I think that's the point that I was making before, is that while the RPS will set the timeframes for achievement of the long-term outcomes, the land and water plan will have shorter time frames within it in terms of the actions that need to be taken and the steps along the way to achieving those long-term visions. So that's why I think we can't just focus on those long-term RPS outcomes. We need to be looking at the action in the shorter time frame.
All right. So do I understand your evidence to be then that what is meant by timely is a reference to timeframes that will be in the land and water regional plan that we don't yet know about?
Sandra McIntyre, that's not actually how I had seen it. And to be honest, I haven't looked very hard at how timely has been used in this, but I have always been of the understanding that timely in relation to that was in relation to the interim period that we're talking about between now and when the land and water plan is in place.
All right. Does anybody else have a different view?
Sally Dicey. In my mind, timely sets up the six-year time frame that is the default that this plan change is seeking to push through. But I absolutely think that if there's a non-complying activity or application that comes in and we have got an RPS that sets out timeframes, that reference could and should be had to timeframes set out in the higher order document for Otago.
Okay. Does anybody else wish to answer before I move on to the next related topic? Then that brings me nicely to...
Sorry, Mr. Page.
Mr. Farrell.
Yeah, Ben Farrell. So I've already talked earlier around the word timely lacks clarification. But just in terms of the response to the specific conversation and the RPS, just firstly note, I'm not aware of the content of RPS, I'm not on top of that. But I would be hesitant to link the word timely in this objective with any RPS if on the basis that the RPS is presumably going to give effect to the MPS and again the concept of Te Mana Tūwai and set out an integrated framework and processes. And so I can't see how there could be a connection between timely and the RPS. If that was intended, it should refer to the RPS or the regional plan framework.
So then we come to the question about what is meant by the words that have been added to both versions of the objective, the interim period. How do we know what that interim period is?
Sandra McIntyre, in my view, we can't really know what the interim period is without referring to the new planning framework, which gets back to my comment about actually being clear about that this is what this plan change is intended to address.
Anybody else wish to contribute to what is meant by the terms, words, the interim period?
I think, Sally Dicey, the start of the objective introduces the concept, the transition toward a new land and water plan, and the interim period links back to that. And some clarity may have been lost around that interim period through the deletion of the words until a new land and water regional plan is made operative, which had been in the previous version. So that was quite clear on what that interim period was. So some of that clarity has potentially been lost through that deletion.
Sorry, Ms. Dicey, could you just tell me what words were deleted?
Sorry, so in the version I'm looking at,
yep.
On page 2, this is the 21st of May.
Yeah.
Yep. So at the bottom of each objection, objective, you'll see the struck through words. Yep.
Yep. And so when that was in, formally, you knew what the interim period was a reference
relating
to.
Relating to, yeah.
Yep. Was the intention in striking out those words to acknowledge that the interim planning framework might extend for a period longer than the intended operative date of the Land and Water Regional Plan of December 2025?
So Sally Dicey, we discussed that in paragraph 2 of the JWS. All planning witnesses agree that the sentence relating to until a new land and water regional plan is made operative is no longer necessary. And that was on the basis of the changes made to the start of the objective, which refer to the new land and water plan, and that functionally the objective will no longer exist in the new land and water plan. But, of course, that doesn't address the time period where the objective does exist and any potential lack of clarity. So planning by committee in a two-day period always presents drafting challenges. Those words still had value.
I guess what I have in mind in asking my questions is a concern raised by particularly a number of the farming witnesses about their level of confidence that the ORC might in fact get its land and water regional plan operative by December 2025, and what happens if it doesn't? And the changes made to the objective might at one level appear to be softening the boundaries of what the interim period means, and my questions are directed to whether that's intentional.
Mm.
Tom de Pulsemaker, that was, in my recollection, not the intent.
Okay. But is it the effect?
It does, Tom de Pulsemaker, it does raise a potential for discretion as to what is now meant with the term interim period. Mm. Acknowledge that it creates some uncertainty and it potentially changes the meaning.
Okay. My next question relates to the addition of words to both versions of the objective enabling existing activities. And my question is, was that intended to refer to the activity of taking and using water, or does that intend to be directed towards what water users are actually doing with it? In other words, in the case of irrigation, they're on-farm activities.
Just pause there a second. I just got to find those words.
Sandra McIntyre, Health Court. It's just, in the...
Ms McIntyre, I just need to find the words in the document so I can understand what your answer is.
Yes, that's... Second to last line of version A.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly in version B.
Ms McIntyre.
The intent was to enable the type and scale of activities that are existing in terms of the water use, the water take in use.
So,
Sally... Sorry, Mr. Page. Sally Dicey, my understanding was also meant to not result in a reduction of allocation resulting in stranded assets that had actually been used. So there, from my perspective, there was a link through to not stranding assets and farm infrastructure that had already been used because there had been access to water. So it was linking... right the way through.
Yes. So are you agreed that it is directed towards the activities that water is supporting, not just the activity of taking the water from the water body?
Tom de Pulsemaker, yes.
Now, for those witnesses who prefer version B, which specifically references giving effect to the NPSFM 2020, and this may have been a topic my friend Ms. Williams for the Department of Conservation may have touched on, if we're going to start referring to the statutory instrument framework, shouldn't we be complete and also refer to the regional policy statement?
Ben Farrell, no, on the basis that that the current regional policy statement does not give effect to the NPS freshwater.
Yes. But to follow that up, Mr. Farrell, given the function that regional policy statements play in the NPS Freshwater Management 2020, shouldn't we anticipate that there will be an RPS that will set out long-term visions for fresh water?
Ben Farrell, yes. And that's where there could be some logic in
referring to the regional plan framework.
Now, I want to move topics now by coming to the policies. The policy 10A.2.1 has been amended by replacing the word actual with historical in relation to rates and volumes of extraction. And my questions about that change are going to be addressed by reference to, I think, sheet 6 of the overview that Mr. De Pelsmaker and Mr. Wilson presented, and I wonder if you have that. It was on the screen, but that would remove Ms. Stiles from the picture, and I don't want to do that. And so there's a plan, I think it's page 6 or 7, which says Schedule 10A.4 limits being based on data spikes, and we have a record with 5 spikes marked in yellow. Do the planners have that?
Everyone see your copy?
Thank you. And so my question for you is that where the policy as it's been amended in the drafting, refers to historical instantaneous rates of abstraction, to the extent that the yellow spikes are below the red line, which is the permit limit, aren't those part of the historical rates of take?
Sandra McIntyre. My... And I suppose the question is whether historical abstraction in terms of this plan change is essentially determined by using the schedule. Now, you know, there are various views about whether you want to refer to the schedules within a policy or not, or whether you just go to the rules to do that. I guess without referring directly to the schedules or to the provision that is allowed for in the RDA in relation to other methods, then there is some uncertainty in the policy as to what historical means, but in practice, in terms of applying this, you would be referring to the rules to interpret it.
Yeah. Well, happily, the technical experts have agreed on the schedule, so we know what that contains. But my question is directed at a policy level. If the schedule is to give effect to a policy or to implement a policy, where is the policy basis for excluding the yellow spikes?
Sally Dicey, the word actual also would include those yellow lines. The policy starts you on that path and the rule completes it. I think the rule provides the detail of what is meant by historic.
My question for you all is, what is the policy reason for excluding what are described as spikes, as shown on the plan, if that's an actual and lawful part of the history of the take?
Sally Dicey, the technical experts may be better to speak to this because we've relied on their input as to whether it does actually reflect actual historic, actual or historic use that was not something other than an erroneous spike. So my understanding is things such as pump startups, which reflects actual or historical, real, necessary part of the abstraction record wouldn't be deleted by this approach. And yeah, I think the technical experts may be better to speak to that because we have relied on them in that.
But so has the technical experts' work on the schedule informed what you understand historical to mean, as opposed to the other way around, that the technical experts have picked up what the policy says and have attempted to deliver the method?
Sally Dicey, yes, the technical experts have sought, my understanding, and they can confirm this themselves, is that a lot of the work has been about not excluding actual abstraction that a permit holder would need to carry on with in the future. So again, it also comes back to that wording, enabling existing activities in the objective. Yeah. So it links back through to that.
Okay. Then perhaps it's time to ask the technical experts to comment on whether you thought you were implementing the what was meant by historical in the now revision of the policy or what the nature of your task was.
Simon Wilson, I think the nature of our task was to come up with a method to define a typical or a reasonable maximum number. There is, looking at this chart, for example, we haven't gone through the exercise of assessing whether those spikes represent actual or historical taking or whether they're an error on the meter or something else. And some may be one and some may be the other. And the method as designed is designed to avoid you needing to go through that process. So it takes care of spiky data and gives you a reasonable or a typical maximum number without having to go through the exercise of is that data point valid and is that data point valid and is that data point valid.
Does anyone else wish to
Simon Wilson, if I can just add while Dr. Bright's looking for that. If I read the wording of this policy as well, to me the key at the start is that there's no increase in. So the policy doesn't say here that you'll get your maximum historical. It just says you won't get more than that. And I think that's what the schedule does reflect.
Hickey?
Matt Hickey. So my understanding of what we did, I don't recall looking at that policy as such to try to develop a method for that policy. Our I guess the way we looked at it was in the joint witness statement for the first one for primary sector under point one, we had three key outcomes that the schedule was designed to achieve. So our focus in working on that schedule was to implement those three key kind of outcomes that ORC sought and the reason for why they had the schedule.
Anybody else? Thank you. Nothing further, Mark.
All right. Mr. Reid.
Thank you. My questions really revolve around this issue of the stranded assets. And I'll just, my learned friend Mr. Moore has already asked you some questions about that. I'll try not to repeat those, but I just have a few additional ones. And what I wanted to do is just, in the first instance at least, ask Mr. Pulsemaker those questions, and then I think give Ms. Dicey and Ms. McIntyre and anyone else that wants to comment the opportunity. So, Mr. DePulsemaker, can I just confirm that you were present or have reviewed at least the evidence from primary sector irrigators and farmers in Cromwell and elsewhere over the course of this hearing? Were you there for all of it? Or?
I was there for 98% of it.
So you're aware of pretty well all the material that was presented?
Yes.
Yes.
I am.
And I just wanted to ask you to confirm that the issue that you understand some parties at least were raising and that the court has sought to address via this amendment is an issue about partially constructed infrastructure, irrigation infrastructure, being unable to be utilised?
Correct. The main infrastructure
yes.
being installed, yes.
But that was the problem that was sought to be addressed, was an issue about infrastructure having been already installed but then not able to be utilised.
Correct.
And you would agree with me that it is a significant issue.
It is an issue that is occurring. Whether it is significant in terms of how frequent or how often is this issue, I don't have a complete view on that.
No.
But it is in a number of cases a valid issue.
So just think, if I can just ask you to think back about those individuals who raised it. So clearly there was Strathclyde in mm-hmm. first instance. Then there was the Webb Partnership. Do you recall
yes.
their evidence?
Correct.
I think that was John Webb.
Yeah.
And he raised that issue specifically in relation to cherries.
Yes.
And then do you recall an issue from the Henny Road Partnership? Another cherry orchard that had a similar issue.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that I could identify in my review. Are there any others that you're aware of?
Not out of the top of my head.
Are you able to tell us whether there was any evidence of individuals who could identify stranded infrastructure that wouldn't be caught by the sort of amendment that's being proposed?
If I can turn the Yeah. If you would turn the question around, does it resolve all the issues that have been raised? Because
I'm only concerned about the issue of stranded infrastructure. I appreciate there are other issues that have been raised by other people. But I'm not concerned about those issues. I'm dealing with the issues of people who have installed infrastructure one way or another mm-hmm. and are then not able to utilise it.
Yeah, and my initial thought is that the amendments proposed would address this issue.
Yes.
Yeah.
And did I understand from what you said previously when you were questioned by Mr. Moore that your understanding from the evidence is that there is a principal justification for adopting this type of approach to the delineation of the main line as the trigger for policy
yes.
recognition?
Correct, yeah.
Can you just confirm what you understand to be that policy that is, justification?
Sorry, are you saying policy justification?
Well, there's a justification in principle for the policy response.
So there is, yeah, that is the trigger, really. The main line irrigation infrastructure needs to be established at a certain point in time, which is notification date, March 2020.
And do you understand the recognition of the main line to be something that has a principal justification in the sense that it accords with how people generally do these types of developments?
Yes. My recollection is that the installation of the main line starts right at the start of the development and is established to accommodate the entire development, even if it takes place over stages.
Yes.
Yeah.
So in your recollection is that there was evidence to that effect?
Yes.
So am I right in saying then that, in summary, that your recollection of the position is that there is evidence of a number of parties affected by this issue, and there is an underlying justification for the policy response.
Correct. Yeah.
So just turning then to the way that the group has dealt with this issue on page 14 and 15 of the joint witness statement. So I think you, just correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that you've gone through the questions that the court has asked and you have identified that in terms of the proposed controlled activity rule, there would be greater clarity to the rule if a definition was introduced.
Correct.
And you've set that definition out in paragraph 60.
Correct, and that was through discussion with technical experts as well.
And then you've gone on paragraph 62 and onwards through to 64 to set out an alternative pathway, which is to effectively introduce similar wording to the rule, but to do it in a restricted discretionary activity context.
Correct.
And then at 62 and 63, you've set out the basis for preferring restricted discretionary activity status for that proposed rule approach.
Correct.
And am I correct in characterising what you've said to be that your concern was that the policy solution or the rule solution as incorporated into the controlled activity rule would be a bespoke solution? Was that the concern?
It, wouldn't call it a bespoke solution, but it definitely is a solution that caters to a limited number of circumstances. The idea of the controlled activity rule is to have a rule in place that is tight, that is that applies in a lot of circumstances. And for that reason, we thought it would be, and also for the reason because council may want to have some discretion around a number of matters that fall out of this issue.
Well, can I just take you back, though, to 62 and 63,
yep.
Because the only issue that's identified there is the issue about this being a bespoke solution.
Yeah. It tailors to a specific situation, yeah.
And the idea of something being bespoke, can I suggest to you, is that it is tailored to an individual situation. Isn't that what bespoke means?
Or a limited number of situations?
Well, wasn't the situation, though, that the evidence that some individuals came along to the court, explained their situation. Mm-hmm. The court has sought to potentially to respond to that situation, and that's an appropriate way for the court to respond to evidence in front of it. Isn't that the situation?
Yes. Yeah.
Is there anything wrong with the court doing that in principle?
No.
And can I suggest to you that it can't be bespoke when there are multiple scenarios before the court where the situation arises and where there's an underlying principled basis for it? That's not a bespoke situation, is it?
No, as I explained previously, this is not catering towards one single one, and that's why, it caters to a number of different situations.
Yes. There were no situations that you were able to identify where the problem of stranded assets was raised, but this rule solution wouldn't respond to them.
Correct.
So just turning then to the issue of the relative effectiveness of these two rule approaches, one being controlled, the other being restricted discretionary. At 63, the group has identified an issue about whether a restricted discretionary activity that covered this point, a restricted discretionary rule that covered this point, could be utilised by Strathclyde because Strathclyde is in the position of being a one water user of many in a scheme. That's the issue that's identified at 63, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that a very legitimate concern?
I think paragraph 63... what it tries to say is that this amendment could provide for Strathclyde, but it will have implications for other shareholders within the scheme of which Strathclyde is part of.
Yes. So it might well be that there are legitimate reasons why the scheme as a whole might not want to go down a restricted discretionary route for one water user.
It is possible.
Because that might run the risk of decline. Wouldn't
correct,
it?
Yeah.
And so it's possible that for Strathclyde and others in Strathclyde's position who are one user on a scheme, that the scheme might choose, for legitimate reasons, not to seek to cater for their situation, and to instead choose the control activity pathway and not address the issue.
Correct.
Sorry, say that again. So there might be, yeah, put that question again. Sorry, I heard the answer correct. I didn't quite hear the question. So there might be legitimate reasons. Yeah.
So there might be legitimate reasons why a scheme might choose controlled rather than restricted discretionary, even when they have a user like Strathclyde on board.
Correct.
So in that sense, the rule would be less effective in addressing the problem, wouldn't it, if some users are unable to utilise the rule pathway?
It would, but it will be hard to craft a rule that works 100% for everybody.
Well, can I just stop you there, though, because the view of the joint witnesses is, isn't it, that the controlled activity rule is fine. It works perfectly well to address this point. That's the position that's recorded, as I understand it, in the joint witness statement, isn't it?
Can you refer me to the paragraph? Paragraph 61, I think it's important to keep the wider context and the wider paragraphs or the wider text in mind. Paragraph 61 is a response or part of a response to a question 16. Are the requirements of the entry condition clear and certain? And so that question is in relation to the draft that was included or the drafting that was included in the agenda. I would like to point your attention to question 18, which then goes on and says, would a restricted discretionary activity status with specific matters of discretion be a more appropriate approach? And the planning witnesses have responded to that in paragraph 62.
Well, yes, I understand that that's what they've done in 62 and 63, 64. But just turning to what the planning witnesses have said about the proposal to address this problem in the control activity rule, which is what's discussed at 60 and 61,
mm-hmm.
It's true, isn't it, that the planners don't identify any issue with dealing with this problem via the controlled activity pathway in the statement?
I think what paragraph 61 is saying is that if it were a controlled activity rule, no additional matters of control are required, which is, in my view, different to saying that the planners think that this is an appropriate pathway.
And the planners don't think it's an appropriate pathway because of the issue about it being a bespoke solution, and that's what you've addressed at 62 and 63.
Correct, yep.
But leaving aside the issue about it being bespoke, which we've already discussed, is there's nothing else, is there, that represents a problem for responding to this issue in the controlled activity pathway?
It takes away from council the ability to decline a consent, so it removes some of the discretion that council has.
Well, that's true. But given that there are no additional matters of control required, why would you want to decline it?
Out of the top of my head, I cannot come up with any specific circumstances. However, when we discussed this matter, we discussed them all planning witnesses and also with input from consents officers. And that is the conclusion that we arrived at.
Yes, thank you. I don't have anything further. Ms. McIntyre, is there something else you want to say?
Sandra McIntyre, I think we had some... I suppose a little bit of discomfort in trying to address this this issue fully in the expert conferencing, because while some planners, and particularly I think Ms. Dicey and Mr. DePalsmaker, have managed to keep up with all or most of the evidence that's been presented to the court, some others of us there haven't managed to be able to keep up with all that. We were presented with a narrow set of circumstances. We didn't have the information available to us to actually understand how those sat in the broader context and what the implications might be in terms of specifically providing for this set of circumstances without any ability for the council to decline. And that is part of the, I think part of the thinking that sits behind that comment on it, on bespoke situations, is that we weren't clear as to how representative this is of the full set of situations we might be looking at, and what the, you know, what the issues were around what sort of information might or might not be available. So that contributed to our caution in relation to providing for this as a controlled activity.
Yes, thank you for that clarification. Ms. Dicey, was there anything you wanted to say?
Sally Dicey, I commented on it earlier this morning. I would be relatively comfortable with this being part of the controlled activity rule, and I am mindful of, for the reason stated in 63, I am mindful of how this affects a scheme such as the Manahere Care scheme with just potentially a single shareholder. So that pretty much closes off actually the whole point of the relief, potentially, if it's put into the restricted discretionary rule and the scheme, for whatever reason, doesn't want to go through that pathway. So I am very mindful of that. And as drafted, I think it could be quite simply taken across into the controlled activity rule.
Yes, thank you.
Right, well, we're going to break for the lunch and adjournment, but one of the factual contexts, the relevant factual context, was set out in Dr. Davin's evidence. His evidence was that if you're putting in irrigation main lines, you're not just catering for viticulture and horticulture, but you're also picking up centre pivots. With that in mind, I suggested perhaps this needed to be an RDA so you could look at the contamination question from centre pivots. Now, I have said this several times since. That is my broader context. I thoroughly understand moving in an uncertain factual context, because I've also mentioned that several times. But insofar as I know anything about irrigation mainlines, is that they can be laid out prior to horticulture, viticulture being established, and prior to centre pivots being established. And it could be a network of centre pivots, not just one, but more than one. So that was my specific concern over the controlled activity. Nevertheless, you may think Dr. Davin was wrong. You may think no contamination risk arises should centre pivots be constructed. But those are my specific concerns, which is why I was pointing in the RDA direction. I'll leave that with you to think about over lunchtime. We're going to come back at 2:30 with the court's questions.
All rise.